Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's February 12, 2014, and this is episode 408. This week, I'm honored and incredibly excited to be joined by Michael Miner, a Los Angeles-based fine art photographer, perhaps better known by some as the co-writer for the screenplay for the 1987 hit movie RoboCop and its sequels. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Martin. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's incredibly exciting for me. You know, I think you're probably the most famous person that's ever been on the show, so it's really nice to be speaking with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So firstly, you know, we'll jump into some, I'm sure that a lot of people obviously already know you as an accomplished fine art photographer, but the fact that you co-wrote the screenplay for RoboCop is a little bit more of a claim to fame. And I believe that the sequel that obviously is based still on your original screenplay, a remake, RoboCop 2014, that premieres today, right?
Yeah, actually, the premiere was last night, so I'm sufficiently unhungover.
Oh, wow.
It was a great experience. I got to meet Gary Oldman and Michael Keaton and the director, Jose Padilla, who has made great films in Brazil. We were all there, the largest IMAX screen in the world on Hollywood Boulevard, and an after party. And it was, it's one of the reasons you kind of stick around this rodeo called Hollywood, because every once in a while something astonishing happens.
Wow! So, really, congratulations. That's
thank you.
Thank you. It's incredible. Thanks so much for coming on the show today. After that, I thought it was tonight. So but that's great.
No, it opens tomorrow. So I think the reviewers were all there last night.
And I see.
My main challenge has been to help the hardcore fans get over the fact that it's not an R-rated film. Because RoboCop has its own essence, and I think 30 or 40 years from now, when I'm gone, they'll still be making more RoboCop films, because it's like Batman or Iron Man. It's a social protest film in the only way Hollywood really knows how to make that, the way that Batman has its own essence. And so I think, not by any conscious effort, Ed and I created this thing that's going to go forward for a while.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. I mean, the essence of the movie, that the way he's, the main character is actually, he becomes like half robot. You called it a social. What was the phrase you used? Sorry, a social statement.
Yeah. So it's a kind of a social protest film, in the sense that it challenges corporate overreach and who owns someone's personality.
Yeah.
And a lot of disempowered people in 1987, at the end of the Reagan era, and especially now, feel more empowered by that character who says, "No, you don't own me. I own myself."
Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible. Obviously you've led a creative life. You've been doing this for a long time. You've been into writing. Obviously, you've got I see that you've done cinematography as well as your still photography. You've produced and directed movies. Have you noticed any parallels that can be drawn between these sort of creative pursuits and your fine art photography?
Yeah, there are a lot of similarities and things that are standalone. I think the biggest difference between still photography and, well, the similarities are obviously composition, understanding light, narrative themes within both moving pictures and still pictures. I think that storytelling has helped me be a better large format landscape photographer, because after about 6 years of shooting and 3 years of printing, I got all the prints together, and I realized that my eye was unconsciously leading me into these portfolios that organized themselves. So there was a kind of pre-literate, I was responding to the environment, and so I went further into researching the art instinct, which actually I think developed along with jealousy, love, greed, faith, all the other Pleistocene characteristics. And so it's very similar in that way. It's different in the sense that a still photograph doesn't have an actor or a soundtrack or a movie score. It's sort of, it has to stand on its own within a frame. And I think the bar is much higher because of that, because it stands on its own as a visual thing. And that's why it's so, I think, so hard to take a good photograph.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, obviously, it's to make the movies that you've been involved with is a huge task, and it's, you know, it in some ways it can't be compared. But yeah, you've got to try and tell a story or have an impact, evoke some sort of an emotion in one frame. So, couldn't agree more.
I think the other thing that I learned from motion pictures, which are it's incredibly grueling both to write them and to direct them, is that you can't quit, you can't stop, or the project will just fall apart. And so when you go out and take a picture and you get back to the lab and it's a little out of focus or the wind moved something, you go back out.
Yeah.
You know, and you do it two or three times. I'm sure you've shown up in places where it didn't work out right the first time, and you just keep trying.
Yeah, absolutely. So how long has the still photography been an important part of your life?
I actually have been shooting stills. I started in 35 millimeter back when I was in an undergraduate in the UC system studying English literature, and I'd play around with a still camera, and I made a short film as an undergraduate, then set up a little 35 millimeter dark room when I moved back to my mother's house because I was underemployed, as many people are after graduating from college. So I printed some things. Jerry Ullman at the time was an influence, so I tried to do these collages on one surface of photographic paper. Obviously, Ullman is such a master, and I didn't do it quite as well. And there was some documentary, street photography, a la Cartier-Bresson and Vivian Meyer and those folks. But again, if you look at someone like Diane Arbus, and you see a proof sheet of all 12 shots of the kid with the grenades in Central Park, I would have stopped at number 6, and she kept shooting, and that 12th image is the one that is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
So I started that way, and I always kept shooting, but it kind of fell off as I went to film school and started directing and photographing films for other people, dabbled a little bit, and then went through some great experiences screenwriting and directing, and some heartbreak and some rejection. And in 2000, after I directed The Book of Stars, which I call the long out, because it was going over the center field fence. We had Delroy Lindo, Jenna Malone, Mary Stuart Masterson, and the center fielder caught it. So it didn't get distribution. Well, I had a falling out with the producers. So I looked around and I said, I'm going to take up something that only I can mess up. So the digital world was just starting out, and I looked at some medium format cameras and then settled on this, a Canham MQC57, which is a 5-pound box camera, field camera, made by Keith Canham in Arizona. It takes a 4x5 and 5x7 back, and I started shooting black and white. I tried color, but to me, color is incredibly difficult. And to transcend the postcard, which there are so many of, it just so I stuck with black and white and have been shooting ever since. In 2010, I acquired a Weyman 8x10 field camera, which also weighs 5 pounds, and took that to the North Rim of the Grand Canyon on my first artist in residence grant. And now I'm shooting mostly 8x10. I think that was secretly the thing I always wanted to do. And I'm printing up to 30 by 40 inches, these monster prints, by myself without an assistant.
Oh, great.
All photochemical, no Photoshop, all handmade things.
Wow. In your printing then, so when you do your 30 by 40 prints, that you mean that you're doing it all in the dark room? You're not scanning and printing on bubble, you know, inkjet paper, or how's that?
Yes, right. That's exactly right. I buy a roll of 98 feet by 42 inch wide Ilford multi grade 4 fiber-based glossy paper.
Wow.
I go into a room with a box that I've made and lined with acid-free paper and blacked out, and get about 38 cuts, 38 sheets of film off of that 100-foot roll. Then lay out all the trays. Everything I've printed has been in a public dark room near downtown in LA, where they have a De Vere 5108 enlarger with anti-Newton glass and huge trays, 35 by 45 inch trays, and about every fourth print gets wrinkled because I'm 6 foot six, so I have a big wingspan, and I can, moving around a wet piece of paper is very hard,
especially
but the results are stunning. I think inkjet is, you know, making progress in leaps and bounds. But I've done tests where I've scanned an 8x10 negative and printed it 30x40, and I hold it up next to the silver halide print, and the chiaroscuro in the silver halide print is just undeniably better.
Wow. Yeah. That's a huge process. I mean, I was expecting that you were at least sort of scanning and then printing on an inkjet printer, but doing it all in the traditional sense, that's just incredible.
It's a royal pain in the ass, I'll tell you.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of processes. I've got to ask, do you enjoy it?
When I'm in the dark room, I actually had a spectacular failure. You're writing a TV pilot that never got produced, even though I think it's one of the best things I ever wrote. I'm taking another run at it. So I quit for about a year. I said, why am I doing this? I've spent 6 months writing this thing. So then I was going into the darkroom, and I found an incredible amount of peace in there. There are about 8 or 10 things you do. It's a little bit like Zazen. It's a meditative process.
Yeah.
And the less cluttered your mind is, because you're manipulating each print individually, it's like real-time Photoshop. And if you have a cluttered mind, it just doesn't work. So, and obviously the magic of the thing appearing in the tray still caters to my 10-year-old sense of wonder. So it is a lot of fun with the process.
Yeah, I used to work in I had a job working for a corporate US company, and I would often, you know, it wasn't an incredibly stressful job, but often the weekends with the camera would be my escape. And, you know, even now running the business, it keeps me in the office behind the desk a lot more than I would like to be. But, you know, you pick up the camera and go out, and everything just changes. It's such a meditative thing. And I think
it really is.
Yeah. I print on inkjet. I've got a large format printer sitting behind me right now. And that too. I mean, I just love to select a few of the best shots from a shoot and just print them out really big. And I mean, it's all done, not darkroom printing, you know, it's all inkjet, but it's just great to see them come out on fine art paper. And it's all part of the process to me. So I can totally relate to that.
I'm a little jealous, I have to say, because it may be, there may be a more direct line from the camera to the paper with your process. And I know at some point I'm going to get tired and have to start doing that way. Because this other way is just, it's hard.
Yeah. Well, if ever you find yourself in Tokyo, you're welcome to come over and stay with us for a few days, and we can play around and print and do.
That's incredible. It's incredibly generous. Thank you, Martin.
No, not at all. It would be a pleasure. So, you know, okay, continuing on this printing thing, you've got your traditional film negatives, and you're doing your own printing. Do you get into all of the dodging and burning and stuff the old Ansel Adams way?
Absolutely. There's a metronome, electronic metronome, ticking 1 second at a time, tick, 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 so I don't have to look at a timer.
Yeah.
And it usually takes anywhere from 5 to 15 minutes of print to manipulate. And actually, the larger the print, the easier it is, because the space opens up and you can see and do and manipulate more, because you're not constrained by... I took a workshop from John Sexton, who has forgotten more about photography than I'll ever learn, and he printed for Ansel Adams. But he prints these 11 by 14s, and I can't believe, you know, how he gets into these little spaces with dodging and burning tools.
Yeah.
I'm doing all of that stuff. Sometimes there are upwards of 25 or 30 different dodging and burning manipulations that happen for a negative.
Wow, that's incredible. I mean, I'm really envious because although I shot film for many years, I was never able to do the darkroom stuff. And so it's I'm sitting here, you know, you're probably sitting there getting all stinky and chemicals thinking, Jesus, I need an inkjet. And I'm the other way around.
Well, I work in the darkroom I work at too. These guys took it over about a year and a half ago, Contact LA. And they're young, terrific. I feel like I'm back in film school. They're in their early 30s. Mm. They just love image making. And they help me incredibly. They've built drying racks. And they give me ideas. I'll come out with a wet print. And they'll go, oh, that needs more contrast. So it's been that part's also a great experience.
Mm. Wow. Incredible. So your photography, generally, that's going to be a solo pursuit. But getting back to the screenplay writing again, you co-wrote the screenplay for RoboClop with Ed Neumeier, right?
Yes.
How do you find the collaboration process? You know, you collaborate with another creative on the writing project. Do you think that this experience has helped your photography in any way? You know, the collaboration part.
You know, that's interesting. You obviously, we don't marry ourselves, and Ed and I probably couldn't be more different than we are, because he is anal and plotting and meticulous, and I have a kind of, I won't say ADD, but I run ahead and I work fast. So, so I will rough out a scene, and he'll come back and rewrite it, and. Or I'll pitch ideas. 10 of them are bad, but the 11th one Ed likes, and that's probably the best idea. So we're very lucky that we found each other, because I don't think either of us individually could have written RoboCop. I'm an old hippie who protested the Vietnam War and understand the dangers of corporate overreach. And Ed was a big comic book guy.
Mm.
So also those two sensibilities really helped make 1987 RoboCop what it was. We're very lucky in that way. With the photography, and obviously directing or shooting a film is a very collaborative thing. You need everyone. The photography is really it is very different. It's a soul pursuit, a little bit like playing the piano. It's not tennis. It's not football. It's not a team sport. So, but that's part, as you were saying, that's the solitude is part of what's really lovely about it. I had the camera set up and was waiting for the light in this deep woods for the Gateless Gate, the tree hallway series, and a bird landed on my boot. and it was there for about 5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so, and I thought, well, this is why I'm here.
Yeah.
And then the light was right and I took a shot. So there are the astonishing things that happen that are unanticipated. It'll start raining, you know, and you're never deep out in the woods in the rain usually, but you're out there and so you put the trash bags over the equipment or you're on a bluff and you see it coming over from the Pacific Ocean and I think, well, it's going to be here in about 20 minutes, so I better get ready. Mm. And then this awful squall comes through and you wait and stand in the rain for 20 minutes and then it's over. And during the clearing, that's when the best light is because the clouds are wild, and it's just terrific.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, dramatic clouds and skies are incredible, aren't they? I love photographing that stuff.
Yeah, it's really, and especially shooting into the sun.
Mm.
There are a lot of photographers, especially film photographers, who are terrified of that.
Yeah.
But I just wait for the clouds to close up just enough. That's really the sort of the reaching. For the pinnacle right there, I think.
Yeah. I think we'd get along great in the field together as well. I mean, you appreciate a lot of the things that I myself do. It's, you know, rules are there to be broken. Someone says never shoot into the sun. It's like, okay, where's the sun? Let's take a go at that.
Right. Yeah. The other one, another photographer, San Francisco photographer, told me one like that. I'm going to try to remember it. if you jump a fence, better to be kicked off private property than to obey. I can't remember the rules, but I don't think I've ever taken a picture where I haven't had to jump a fence.
Mm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's, I used to do the same thing. I mean, when I was a kid, it's like keep out signs. I mean, you come in, welcome, take a walk around.
That's right. The one place I go a lot, at Point San Simeon on the central coast of California, I usually, especially when the sun's going to be up, I get there at 5 a.m. because I only have until about 10, because then the sun is blasting through. Hmm. So this last time I went up there, I threw all the equipment over the fence, jumped over and looked up, and there was a bull right two feet away from me looking at me.
All of a sudden, your 5-pound camera takes on another meaning.
Exactly.
So, you know, you're shooting a lot on the West Coast there, and I understand that you've just opened an exhibition of your work called Nature LA at the G2 Gallery in Los Angeles.
Yes.
How did that come about, the exhibition?
It's interesting. G2, you have to be recommended as a photographer for the portfolio review to happen. So I went on a portfolio review, and an LA Times photo critic said, I'm going to recommend you to G2. And so I got the email query and loaded up things, images, and sent it off, and then a robot response came back that said, thank you for your submission. Please do not try to contact us. We will be in touch with you if we are interested in going forward. I forgot about it. Year and a half later, I get an email that says, we're doing a portfolio review for just one day, and it was the day I was returning from the Big Island of Hawaii. So we flew on the red eye. I slept for a couple hours and then went down and met with Jolene Hansen, who is this amazingly energetic curator. I had been able to move the review to the end of the day, which meant that she was just didn't have any pressure. She immediately fell in love with the images and programmed me into a show. It took about 3 months to really get all of the images together. There are 4 30x40 images, 6 24x30 images, and 4 20x24 images, which I also mounted and framed.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's terrific. The gallery is owned by Susan and Daniel Gottlieb. It's maybe the only gallery in the United States, or maybe the world, that gives all of its percentage of sales to environmental causes. It's all nature photography. They become collectors as well. They have a great Ansel Adams and Glenn Gordon Ketchum collection. Elliot Porter color work, the Cibachromes. They bought an Ansel Adams portfolio that Jolene showed me. So they become sort of players in the collecting world to establish their legitimacy, and they're just wonderful people. I invited Susan Gottlieb to the RoboCop premiere last night because she's a big RoboCop fan. So I've gotten a whole new family through this experience as well.
Wow, that's incredible. They are donating all of the profit basically to these various charities. I think that's such a noble thing to do, especially in this day and age when you know, I mean, you've got to make money. You've got to make enough to keep things going. And I'm assuming that they are taking the running costs out before they pay the excess or whatever it is to charity. But that's such a great thing to be doing in this day and age.
Oh, it's terrific. Yeah, I think that Daniel was a prosecutor in the DA's office for several years and then moved into financial management and real estate and, you know, made some very smart moves and then was able to turn around and give some things back. And I've had dinner at their house. There are these Tom Mangelson, big color animal photographs. It's a stunning collection in their house.
Wow.
And the G2 itself, yeah, they have a really bright young staff of, I think it's 5 or 6. So they are salaried, and the rest goes to the NRDC and a number of other charities.
Mm. Wow, that's great. So, for example, you know, we've got a lot of aspiring pros. We've got, you know, for on the listener base here, we've got a lot of beginners, a very broad listener base. But if someone was wanting to get into a similar sort of thing, finding gallery representation, or can you offer any advice for aspiring photographers like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I've had gallery owners say, only show 10 or 20 images. Mm. I think persistence is the key. I'm also represented up at Photography West in Carmel, and I had to go through three portfolio reviews before I was accepted. I was accepted on the fourth one by Carol Williams, and I just got better and better all the time, and I just kept coming back. I have a review scheduled at the Westin Gallery with Richard Gadd, who's become a fan, and it's the fourth review. As starting out, you just have to remember you're not going to knock it out of the park the first time, and you just have to be patient, and you get better. I know that some of the images I was trying to get accepted 4 or 5 years ago, I wouldn't include in my portfolio now.
Yeah, well, that's a big thing. I mean, we always find that, you know, that our current work, I believe, should always be our best, but it gets old quickly. You know, you look back at work from just a few years ago and think, what was I thinking?
Exactly.
Yeah. But I think that as well, I mean, you've mentioned you had screenplays that didn't go, you know, that didn't actually make it into the world, and you sound obviously very, very resilient. You try, you get knocked off the horse, and you jump right back on. And I think that is a big part of your success.
You know, that's a very good point. Two things about that word resilience. After Sandy Hook and the terrible tragedy there in Newtown, the word of counselors went into the community, and they were talking a lot about resiliency to the survivors. So I think that's a very important word. The other part of the process that I learned from screenwriting is a Buddhist concept from D.T. Suzuki called the beginner's mind, in that the principle being that you approach every project as if it's the first time you're doing it, but you have the craft now. You have some craft and you have some wisdom, but you don't let the thought of defeat or the emotional clutter from previous failures cloud the process.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously it's not so much about the gear as it is the end results, but when you're using the medium format and large format cameras and, you know, your big 5-pound gorillas that you hump around the field, it's obviously got to be it's important to your process. So let's talk a little bit about that. You've mentioned the cameras that you use. What does your gear bag look like when you walk out of the house?
Everything together, including the lunch and water and tripod, is somewhere between 50 and 60 pounds. And wow. I can go about 5 miles in, but I have to gauge things so that I know I can walk out. You know, so, and for up until 2012, I had a breathing problem. I had a restricted trachea and had it surgically repaired through a new experimental process only a year and a half ago. So I was not just carrying 60 pounds of gear. I was huffing and puffing.
Wow.
The bag has, the 8x10 bag has the body of the camera in a its own separate bag, two other backs, the 8x10 back on the camera, a 4x5 and a 5x7 back, separate and little soft computer bags. Yeah. Peripherals like a carpenter's level, depth of field charts, red Sharpie, cable release, and somewhere between usually 5 and 7 lenses, almost all of them Fuji lenses made between 1968 and 1978. They stopped down to F45. I never shoot smaller than F32 because of dispersion. And even at F32, there's dispersion, but the 8x10 size of the sheet film overpowers the dispersion problems.
Right.
So and coverage is an issue because you have to have a lens that projects an image circle past the borders of the 8x10 sheet film. So I have a Schneider 110 millimeter XL, which barely covers an 8x10, and the comparable 35 millimeter size for that would be extremely wide angle. Something like if 50 is normal, it would be like a 20 or an 18.
Wow.
And I have a 180 millimeter Fuji, a 210 millimeter Fuji, a 250 Fuji, a 300 Fuji, a 350 old Kodak lens that this guy, the portrait photographer Koresh, uses, a 450 Nikkor, and a 600 Fuji.
Wow.
And so those all have lens boards, and they go on the end of this, you know, very simple box.
Yeah.
And then there's obviously the water and the filters. I use filters a lot. I use red filters when shooting the ocean and a blue-green filter when shooting in the woods because I'm shooting on overcast days, and it gives me an extra couple of stops in into the white area.
Yeah.
Things that are gray that are bathed in overcast blue light get pushed toward white.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm aware of the concepts because I use them, again, in digital. I use Nick Software's Silver Effects Pro, and we have a whole bunch of colored filters that you can apply.
Oh.
And they give you the same effect, but it's basically taking the color after you've captured it in the raw file, and then it runs them through a similar sort of filter. But it's great that you're obviously. I mean, if your whole process, you don't go into the digital darkroom at any point, you've got to use those filters. And it sounds as though you know your whole process is very traditional and. You know, maybe by some thought of as laborious, but, you know, you've got this Zen aspect there, and I can really appreciate how soothing it probably is just to go through these processes in the field and work through each one at a time.
Well said. It does get you compositionally ready, too. It's a little bit like scuba diving. You have 8 or 10 things that you have to get right, and then it opens the doors to perception because it's a little bit like, it is a very, very well put, Martin, a Zen aspect to it. And also the 8x10 viewfinder just really helps compositionally. And this goes to the printing of the 30x40 prints as well. You're sort of present in the picture, as opposed to the picture being a window where you look through into the picture. You have your body has a relationship with the composition in the 8x10 viewfinder and with the print. When you're standing in front of a 30x40 print, you can feel your body communicating with it.
Yeah.
And I didn't really discover that until I started printing that large, and it was, you know, it was a thrilling discovery to experience that.
Wow. Yeah, I remember the first when I first got this large format printer. It's not a huge large format. It's 24 inches wide. So the biggest prints that I can do on a 3x2 aspect is 24x36.
But that's fun. That's big.
Oh, it's still pretty impressive when you print something out and lay it out on the table. The first big print that I did, my wife came up and into the studio and took a look and just burst into tears. It's just the way they affect you. It's totally different.
Beautiful. You're absolutely right. It's really a very fun part of the process.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, as you're composing, we're talking about how the whole process helps your composition. You're looking at it on the back of the ground glass, right? So it's all inverted vertically.
Yeah, it's upside down, absolutely. And in a way, and John Sexton taught me some things about that when he gets lost in the printing process, he'll turn a print upside down to get back to some fundamentals, like is something running off the frame in the wrong way? Are the three areas, top, middle, and bottom, balanced properly? And you start seeing things in a more fundamental compositional way when it's upside down. So I think in some ways it helps.
Yeah. I was thinking that, you know, that was going to be the part of what I was going to follow on with there, is that I imagine flipping it the way it is on the ground glass is it reduces it to graphic elements rather than an easy to perceive scene. So I can imagine how that would be.
Absolutely. And you end up making just panning and tilting and skewing subtly with the final settings. It can be very important. I mean, obviously, if a cloud comes up and surprises you and blocks out the sun, I think I can set the camera and everything up in about 5 minutes now. And I just had to do that in December. I got six sheets of film, and the sun opened up over this bay with some headlands and rocks. And I had to climb, lay down a rope and slide down a very wet, steep, I carry 50 yards of rope with me too, you know. And so I got down there, and the sun was about to go away, but I got everything set up and I'd been trying to get this one location for like 5 years.
Yeah.
And there was always like, also the exposures are usually very long, some of them up to 2 minutes. So if there's a breath of wind, or if the tide coming in hits one tripod leg, out of focus.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So you, obviously, we're going to take a look at some of the images in a moment. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about that then. Before we move into that, I wanted to just mention, you talked earlier about your previous artist in residence assignment. You're doing it again in this year for the National Park Services has you as the artist in residence, and you'll be spending time in the Grand Canyon, I believe.
Yes.
So what sort of things are you bearing in mind as you prepare for these really special assignments?
The National Park Service, I got so lucky the first time in 2010. It was my first time I ever applied, and they invited me to the South Rim of the Grand Canyon in January, and I was on the second floor of Faircamp's, the gift store there, looking right into the canyon, and it snowed 10 feet in January. I lost 20 pounds. I was able to stay in a cabin at Chaco Canyon because I drove over there at the end of my stay at the South Rim. And Chaco, if you don't know, is I guess it could be characterized as the pyramids of America. They're thousand year old structures made by Anasazi Indians that they don't know very much about. And I also prepared a lecture that I presented three times in a camera demonstration, and that's when I started thinking about what other art scholars call the art instinct. So I'll be lecturing there at the North Rim. I managed to get the dream period the last week of September and the first 2 weeks of October. So there'll be the changes of colors. The quakies will be losing their leaves. There might be a little bit of snow. A lot of weather will be rolling through because that's the Colorado Plateau. And so I'm looking at working as much as I can outside. I've been to the North Rim probably six or seven times. My father took me there when he was alive, and my wife and I have gone there a couple of times. So I know these places now where I'm going to set up the camera. And I'm just really excited to get out there and start exposing film, and the presentation is interesting. And I think you will help me with this, Martin, by just your podcast. I want to give a TED lecture on the art instinct and our evolution from Pleistocene to Holocene human, and that's part of the essence of my lecture with the Artist in Residence grant. And basically, should I get into that, or
do we absolutely, want to look? Yeah. I'm intrigued.
The Pleistocene lasted around 1.8 million years, roughly from 1.8 million years ago up to about 10,000 years ago. And Homo sapiens, as we are now, were hunter-gatherers. This was before cities and money and domesticated animals. But they were essentially like you and me. So anthropologists believe that all of the things that are instincts, jealousy, greed, love, envy, faith, and appreciation of art developed during that time. Because from 10,000 years until now is only 600 generations, whereas during the Pleistocene, that was 80,000 generations, a cauldron of evolutionary development. So when we go out into the woods and we feel great and we appreciate these scenic views, it's touching a Pleistocene part of us where the sun was going down, we were looking for a safe place where there was water and maybe an animal we could kill. So now a Bierstadt painting or an Ansel Adams shot in Yosemite Valley is what Pleistocene humans were looking for.
Yeah.
So those masters understood that, and it became a part of seeing. And so I try to transmit that to people who go to the national parks and say, when you feel good, when you're out here in the woods, it's because you're getting in touch with a more primitive self that was out here all the time.
Yeah. Wow. I haven't heard that. It's really fascinating.
I can send you a link, an Amazon link to a book called The Art Instinct, which I think you'll really enjoy because you've been out on the edge in these places, and so I think I'll send that to you when we're done.
That'd be brilliant. I'll not only include a link to that in the show notes, but I'll probably pick up a copy myself because I'm really fascinated by that. Thanks for raising that.
Sure.
So we've talked a lot about your art, your photographs, and you've sent me five beautiful pieces that we're going to walk through now.
And thank you.
I wanted to just let the listeners know that, as usual, you can get to the blog post for this episode with the episode number. So it's mbp.ac/408. And if you go over there, I'll put a few show notes in and the links that Michael's talking about here now. But also, we've got the five photographs that we're going to walk through. So, and you can also view these in the Enhanced podcast if you subscribe to that. But the first one up here, I mean, again, we're getting back to this real beautiful Zen feeling. You've got the primordial boulder image. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, that is a rock. This is a king tide, which is about 5.5 feet. I am way back in a cove. And the waves, this is a 2-minute exposure.
Yeah.
Waves are breaking furiously over this rock and washing up right to my feet. and I'm probably, I would say, at least 50 or 80 yards away. And which means that the tripod can't move at all. And that's what flattens out the water to make it seem sort of like clouds and captures the water running off of the rock.
Yeah.
And it's in a portfolio that I'm calling The First Day. And basically it's all images like this at the moment of creation when the oceans receded. So that's the narrative content within all of these images. And this one in particular, it's an 8x10 negative. There's a horrible spot above the horizon on the right side that was sheet film. When there's a dirt on the negative, it ends up being a black dot. So what you have to do, which means it's a hole in the film,
yeah.
Essentially. It's clear. So I have to come up with a spotting pencil and dot it out. So on the print, it's white. And then I have to come along with toner and spot it out. So this one was a horrible. I had to put on Brian Eno and smoke a little marijuana in order to spot this thing, because it's just like, it's very difficult.
Wow, that's crazy. I realized that people such as yourself that work in the darkroom like that use these toning pens and things, but I would never have thought of the reason why you would need to do that, and that's just fascinating.
Yeah, it's really, dirt is everywhere. I blow out my film holders, but you don't know until sometimes even a couple weeks later, especially when we go over to the Big Island of Hawaii. I'm shipping everything, but I don't see proof, so I'm kind of shooting blind. Although I do have what used to be called a Polaroid back, and I use 4x5 Fuji black and white Polaroid type film to make sure that I'm my exposures are right. I expose one at the beginning of the day. Mm. I've got about 200 in my refrigerator because they've stopped making them.
Wow.
So probably that'll last me as long as I'm shooting.
Yeah. Well, that touches on an important aspect. I imagine you use a handheld light meter. I can't imagine you'd be guessing at your exposures, or you've got no histogram to rely on and things like that. So how does that process work? You set up and then start doing spot reading off various parts of the scene?
Absolutely. Sometimes there's not enough time to do a Polaroid. So I'm using Honeywell Pentax spot meter and relating it to the traditional zone system. And I usually find something to place that I think is going to, I'm going to want to be white. And I put that usually four stops over, sometimes three. Try to get black as well. But again, the filters, especially in the woods, help, because sometimes I'll meter the lightest and darkest areas, and it the meter tells me only about three stops difference.
I see.
So when I put on that blue-green filter, it pushes the whites higher, and then I can I know that there'll be a fall off at the bottom of the range where I'll get some good blacks.
Wow. It's all so technical, and yeah, it's kind of making me want to try this even more, because I love getting my hands dirty on the technical. It's great.
Yeah, I wish I was as technical as John Sexton, you know, with platinum printing and bleaching the negatives. He did that for us during the workshop, because I have a couple of things that are a little muddy, but I really would love to print them, but I haven't been able to get into that area yet. John is just terrific with that stuff.
Wow, yeah. So the next image that you sent is called The Chaos Theory. And, as we go through these, the listeners will note, obviously, the scenes that you're finding lend themselves to this, but you can almost sense a little bit of the RoboCop screenplay writer in you, as your titles are very dramatic. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's been a developing process, but a friend of mine who's a photographer said that the title is very important.
It is, yeah.
And so, yeah, this is in the Del Monte Forest up in Monterey, near where my mother-in-law lives. And I walked past this scene a number of times. I tried to capture it in a 5x7 image. And then one day, the sun was just peeking in and out. And I'm back about 100 yards away with a 600mm lens. So there's a lot of compression in this picture.
Yeah.
Two of my mentors, one of them, I think, if he was alive, would appreciate this picture. He's a painter named Charles Birchfield, and he did quasi-mystical landscape paintings only within about a 10-mile radius of where he lived in Pennsylvania, and several of his paintings have this wild quality to them.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy. It is almost like a... an animated forest of crazy creatures growing in as many different directions. I just get tickled every time I look at this picture.
Yeah. Yeah. So for the sake of the listeners, you mentioned the compression. We're obviously here talking about how a very long lens compresses the elements. A wide angle lens generally you can take a photo of a boulder in the foreground and anything past that looks so far away. It's unbelievable. And that what's happening here is obviously the reverse of that, where a long lens will take all of the elements and stack them very close together. And
yes.
I think that this image it really does make good use of that effect. There's so much in here. I would love to stand in front of this at 30x40.
You know, I'm looking at an inkjet of this, which is 4x5 feet. and it's right by our dining room table, and you can see a little pine cone sitting down on the right foreground. The inkjet clumps up a little bit and looks a little sooty, but I would love to do what Clyde Butcher is doing and print this on fiber paper at 4x5 feet at some point. But I'd need some help with that.
Yeah, well, I would just really love to. How long is the G2 Gallery exhibition going to be running for?
Until March 2nd. Yeah.
I'm not going to get a chance to see that, I don't think. But that if for the listeners, if anyone's in the area, go over and take a look, because I would, this one's, is this included in that?
Yeah, this one is a 30 by 40 is included in the show, absolutely. And it's fun to stand in front of.
Wow, I can imagine. I almost feel as though I'd be there trying to walk into it, just lifting my leg up and, yeah, right. Incredible. So the next one that you have here, again, a very sort of daunting feel to this. It's Overcoming Physical Death, another great title. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Thank you. Yeah, it's actually, this is in Atwater, California, on the way to my accountant's, right next to the number 5 freeway. Mm-hmm. I'm poking a 90 millimeter Nikon lens through a fence. I wish I'd been able to back up a little bit, but the fence would have come into the shot. And the title is from a Zen Koan. Zen Koan's the most popular one is, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And they're phrases that the masters present to their students to try to break down their rational minds. And obviously, living in Japan, you know all about this, Martin. So the idea in Buddhism is that there is a place of enlightenment that one can reach where there is no coming or going, there is no physical death. And this portfolio takes, there's a portal at Chaco Canyon of doorways. There are a number of Japanese and Chinese grave sites on the Big Island of Hawaii that are overgrown with all kinds of vegetation and ferns. The interesting thing about those images, there are no Stars of David's or crosses or any religious iconography. So they're a little bit like a back road in New Orleans. There's something hermetic and cryptic and very old about these images, and I think that title helps a person slip into that mood of, you know, thinking about their mortality and what that actually means, both personally and in a cosmic sense. So that's the goal, anyway.
Yeah. Wow. It's got incredible mood, this image. You just want to, it's kind of scary, but at the same time, you know, you start thinking to yourself, stairways are always very, they make us conjure up all sorts of images. So it's great the way, and it's just so raw and gritty. It's well found as well.
Well put. And you know, it's because it's behind a fence, it's a stairway that no one has walked on for, I don't know, years.
Yeah.
So all of the needles, the pine needles and the ivy and everything, it's an undisturbed place where one should walk but hasn't. So there's that, those forces are working in it too, I think.
Yeah, incredible.
Thank you.
So the next one, another, again, I love this, and I can see it. You know, we've got the Griffin Metamorphosis. obviously, we can see him there in the middle of the frame. But tell us a bit about this one.
This is up on top of Mount Figueroa behind Lake Kachuma near Santa Barbara. It's at about 8,000 feet, and clouds, everything was overwhelmed with clouds, and I was driving down a dirt road and looked over my shoulder, and there was this thing, this beast in the woods. And so I set up the camera, and then the fog rolled in, and this is just a hole in the fog. Obviously, you can see the background has been it kind of closed out by moisture in the air. This one is 24 by 30 in the G2 show, and obviously is related to the portfolio has to do with Ovid's Metamorphosis, which at the time it was written, the ancient mind animated nature with imaginary creatures, the metamorphosis of heroes into animals, gods into humans, was a central part of this sort of pagan point of view on nature and life. And I think that, you know, we see forms in nature all the time, or I do, and this portfolio And again, there's no Photoshop here, which is another sort of fun part of the process, that, you know, this was sculpted by nature itself. Mm. So this is a popular image. I've sold a number of them. And again, it is a kind of creepy, scary, but also fascinating.
I mean, looking at this, when you start breaking it down, obviously the griffin there with his, you know, looking over, is obviously a very central part of the image. Literally, it's, you know, this is one of the times when bullseyeing the main focal point works really well. But then you've got these triangles that, you know, graphic elements. You've got one triangle working in from the left across to the right side, and then cut off on either side. You've got another triangle going across, smaller on the right, going off bigger on the left. And then you've got another beautiful triangle in the top right-hand corner. And then, of course, there's one in the bottom. It's like one, two, three, four triangles here, all working together in the composition.
And I didn't even see that, Martin. That's great. Thank you.
It's like I'm looking at it. I'm thinking that, you know, there's so much. We look for graphic elements like triangles, circles, and squares, and all of these leading lines. And I just find this so beautiful. It's so easy to look at and yet so interesting. So I think it's probably a favorite as well.
Coming from you, that's great praise. Thank you very much.
Oh, not at all. So the last one we have here is Gateless Gate, another great title. I love this, and a beautiful photograph. Tell us a little bit about this.
This is the one where the bird landed on my boot.
Oh, okay.
and again, the Gateless Gate is a Zen koan, which challenges the rational linear mind. Mm. And there is this area in Central California that has all of these paths that have been formed over 20 or 30 years. And so the portfolio has, I would say, 10 successful images in it. I've been going into this place probably a dozen times. Mm. And some of these print up to 30 by 40. A different one, I think, is in the show, G2 show at 30 by 40. This is a 24 by 30. Again, a very popular portfolio. I've sold a number of images out of this portfolio, and the sun was coming. The ocean is about 100 yards to the right, so there's a wind that's blowing across this headlands, and the fog is coming in and out, so that it's kind of the light's bouncing.
Mm, yeah,
too hot, too dim, and so it's a 30-second exposure, and the sun happened to just peek out and hit these various areas of the image just at the right time. And it's a shot at f 35. Wow. With a 210 millimeter lens on an 8x10 sheet of film. So it's roughly, if 350 or 300 is normal at 8x10, so it's slightly wide.
Yeah.
And it just prints, you know, there are about 20 manipulations in this to bring out and suppress various areas of contrast. Again, a blue-green filter.
Mm.
And this is, I think this is one of my most successful images.
Wow. I can see why. I just want to, if I was standing in front of this on a gallery wall, I'd be lifting one leg up trying to walk into it. You can also see how you're very meticulous with your framing. You've obviously lined up the edge of the trees on the left and the right to frame the image, and then you've got this subsequent layers of trees going in. And to me, that one, there's like a kind of a rounded bulbous tree trunk in the middle of the frame there. I want to look around it. I want to get in and peek around there and see what it's hiding, you know, because it's obscuring half of the back end of the path, and it's like, okay, what's behind there? It's incredible.
Thank you.
Not at all. I mean, you've shared 5 beautiful images with us there, and we're over an hour, so we'll start to wrap this up. But is there anywhere, obviously what I'll do is I'll include a link to the G2 gallery in the show notes. Anywhere else that people can go to catch up with you online, or?
Yeah, there's actually, I can send you 2 other links, one to my website, which is about a year behind my printing, and there's the Photography West Gallery in Carmel, California, which also has a number of images, and their website is terrific. I'm in a collection with I feel honored. There are a number of terrific artists there, including Brett Weston, Christopher Burkett, the color photographer, and Paul Caponegro.
Oh, wow.
A number of great artists, Rolf Horn, Morley Bayer, Michael Kenna, Sean Kernan, Roman Larank, number of terrific, Robert Taylor, Don Worth, who we lost a couple years ago. And so I feel incredibly privileged. It's, you know, it's the West Coast is a mecca for a certain kind of photography. And I, you know, thank God, Allah, Buddha, whoever, Martin Luther King, you know, I've I've been able to land in the midst of these great masters, and hopefully I'm my work will be consistent and worthy of being included.
Well, I think you're obviously you're up there with them with the quality of your work. So I'm pleased to see you in there. I'm pretty sure. He almost ran the other way when he saw me. We were in Hokkaido, where Michael Kenna does a lot of his beautiful photography.
And, oh, yeah. I have that book, Japan. It's beautiful.
It's amazing, isn't it? And we walked down onto the beach at the Lake Kusharo, and I'm 99% sure it was Michael Kenna standing on the beach with his medium format. I think it's a Hassi. And he looked across and saw me and 13 other photographers walking down the beach and sort of scarpered the other way. But I know that he likes his solitude. It was him and one other person. I know he travels with a Japanese person as a kind of a guide when he's here. So I'm pretty sure it was him, but I wish I could have got a chance to say hello because I love his work as well.
Oh yeah, I'm surprised that he ran. But I understand when you're out shooting, you really want to shoot.
Right. Yeah, our eyes met for a moment, and he turned away and walked off. So I wasn't going to run after him and say hello. But yeah, so really though, thanks very much for joining us today, Michael. It's been a blast, and I've learned a lot from your conversation about the traditional printing and photography techniques. And once again, congratulations on RoboCop 2014, and you know, just thanks so much for being here today.
Well, thank you, Martin. You're incredibly generous to let me share my work with everyone, and keep up the good work. I mean, it's a only by spreading the word can we keep this, you know, the fine art photography alive.
Absolutely. Well, really, thanks so much. It's been a blast.
Great, thank you.
That really was so much fun. Thanks again to Michael for coming on the show today. And remember, as I said, you can go over to the website at mbp.ac/408 and check out the beautiful images, and I'll embed the links and everything in there as well. But thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Note too that Craft and Vision's quarterly digital magazine Photograph issue 6 is now out, and this issue includes Q&As and portfolios from Hal Eastman, Scott Rickenberger, and Nathan Worth, all of them full of breathtaking photography and thoughtful interviews about why and how they do their work. And all the regular columnists continue to write from our hearts, so we have Jean-Paul Caponegro, Bruce Percy, Chris Orwig, Adam Blasberg, Piet van den Eynde, and yours truly, Martin Bailey, all with articles about composition, creativity, studio lighting, camera craft, printing and post-production. As usual, I'm proud to be a contributor to this fantastic issue. 140 great ad-free pages filled with inspiration and education for creative photographers. And you can jump over there to grab your copy with the short link mbp.ac/CVP6 for Craft and Vision Photograph 6. And I'll put links to the show in the show notes as well, of course. But thanks so much for listening today. Remember that you can find me on Google+, Twitter, Facebook, etc. And links to everything that I'm up to are at martinbaileyphotography.com. So do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode. Hopefully I'll be back in Hokkaido, but I'm going to try and do another episode before I leave. In the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.